Unbelievable, no? Come on, it's unbelievable. When God told Shmuel to anoint David, he said, anoint him because he's got beautiful eyes. What does that mean? Yes, he's a murderer. Yes, he will kill people, but only on the directives of the Sanhedrin. He'll be my agent of war. Anoint him. That's what I want. I want a soldier king. And he's got nice eyes. He'll follow the Sanhedrin. When God says things like that, you have to understand his language. He's not talking, oh, I like them. They're blue. They're very pretty. He means his eyes will follow the eyes of the generation, the Sanhedrin. When Boaz in Pasuk 9 says, Einoich besodeh, he says, follow the Sanhedrin's rulings. He's talking to a Gioras. He's telling her, keep your eyes on the field. Keep your eyes only according to the laws of the Sanhedrin. Only go in the Derech HaTorah. And follow after them. Harvest the words of Torah. Notice, Rus is read on Shavuos. Haven't I commanded the laborers to refrain from molesting you? You will be saved from problems in life if you do what the Sanhedrin tell you. And don't be in a dangerous situation. I'm telling you, says Boaz. Look, it looks to the outsider who reads this pasuk, it looks that he's got, for want of a better euphemism, his eye on her. He's taken a fancy to this woman. That's what you would read into this pasuk. You stay here with me. I'm giving you special preference. Why would he do that? A glossary reading of this would mean that you would fill this in with all kind of basal ideas. When you read the Medrash behind this, Boaz is giving her stark musa. He's the Godel Hador. He's like Rav Shach or the Chofetz Chaim, speaking to a new Gioras that's just walked into Judaism. His main message is, keep to the laws. Do what the Sanhedrin tell you. And don't put yourself in danger. I've commanded my laborers for molesting you. If you go to other fields, you may be putting yourself in a place where you'll be molested. I've got news for you. If you do that, it's an Aveira. Putting yourself in a Mokum Sakana, in a place of danger, is an Aveira. Forget the fact you'll be molested, which is by the by. You'd have done a sin by allowing yourself to be molested. You're not allowed to put yourself in danger. That's what he's telling her. Follow the rules of the Sanhedrin. Don't put yourself in danger. This is where David learnt out the fact that when the three soldiers broke rank, you can't take their laws on, from Boaz telling Ruth, don't put yourself in danger. I've organised that you won't be in danger in this place, so stay there. I'm telling you, if you go somewhere else, you'll be over the halacha of the eyes of the Sanhedrin. That's how David knew that the three soldiers coming back he can't listen to, because his Rebbe Shmuel, and Shmuel wrote this pasuk. Shmuel wrote this. And his Rebbe is saying, look, that's what happened to Boaz. Isn't that amazing? You'd never have thought, the basic reading, keep your eyes on the field. What does keep your eyes on the field mean? What you should do, just look at the field like this. Obviously, we have to understand, keep your eyes on my field in like a general kind of cultural placement with the whole canopy and the harvest festival and stuff. But keep your eyes in the field, keep your eyes, and Sanhedrin, that's what the God Lador is saying to us. All the Midrashim are saying the same thing. That's how to understand this pasuk. So when you read this pasuk in the basic translation, even the translation is accurate in Art Scroll, it's inaccurate in its message. The way to read this pasuk should be, and I'm reading into it now with the Midrashim, always follow the path of the judges. Do not put yourself in a place of danger, for doing so will be a sin to God. All of that is subtext in pasuk tes. That's what we're learning out from this. Mamish, unbelievable, no? You'd have never never got that without the Chazal. You'd never have thought that by yourself. You need the code words. Eyes are the Sanhedrin. You need the limud, the Torah limud, of putting yourself in danger is not allowable. You're allowed to have shlich tzedakah geld when the planes are fine. But if you're getting on a plane with a burning engine, you can't say, don't worry, someone gave me 50 quid to put in a tzedakah box, everything will be fine. You're not allowed to do that. It's an aveira. If you become thirsty, he says here, if you become thirsty, you should go to the jugs to drink what the laborers have drawn. Do you need the God? Has the God? Have you ever met a Rav and he tells you how to drink like water when you're thirsty? He ever said that to you? What's going on here? How to ask for a drink? Boaz needs to tell Ruth, a Moabite princess, how to get herself a glass of water? What does he mean to say? He says like this, my orders to the workers to leave you alone only apply if you take precautions not to mingle with them. If you do, you'll be putting a lifnei eiver, a stumbling block, in front of the blind. We know how these boys are, and you're a very attractive woman. You've got to do your bit. If you feel thirsty, you may come to ask one of them to give you a drink. Now, if it happens they don't have water with them, you may be tempted to request one of them to get the water. And while all this is going on, you're probably going to strike up a conversation. Better that you should go to the water jugs yourself. Don't ask if there's water available, but rather go and see for yourself. Notice Buria, the wife of Rebbe Meir, was out on the street one day. One of the famous sages of the day was on a donkey and he was lost. And he said, excuse me, madam, could I please ask you which way is Lud? She screamed at him, haven't you heard the Mishnah? You should not converse excessively with a woman. You should have said, which way Lud? Keep it tight, Loshen. What are you doing? Schmoozing me? You're schmoozing me up? That was Rebbe Meir's wife. That's a tough woman. Buria, she says, you know, she taught the Amoraim behind a curtain. Many of the halachas we have come from Buria. She used to give shir. That was a tough, tough lady there. Which way, Lud? That's what you should have said. Boaz is saying even further, don't speak to them. Go and draw the water yourself. Don't get involved in any conversation with these lads. Note that the pasuk does not say, drink that which is in the jugs. How do you know someone hasn't been taken up water and left it on the shelf? Drink from that. Drink from what's been drawn. Don't attempt to draw the water yourself, because one of them might rush over to help you, to offer to do it for you, and take the rope from you. And you'll refuse, and you'll both be left holding the rope, and then people will look at you and think, oh, what's going on with these two? Don't draw the water at all. Drink only from what they have drawn. What they've drawn, you take from them. Put your cup out and walk off. Have nothing to do with them. Keep yourself safe. By the way, his words also implied that she should only drink if she became thirsty, not to cool herself down. If you look at the verse carefully, it says actually that he's quite harsh. He says, if you become thirsty, you should go to the drugs and drink from what the laborers are drawn. Not if you just fancy a drink. It's a sweltering hot day. Only if you become thirsty should you ask for a drink, and that will lessen the chances of you hanging out at the water cooler, chatting to all and sundry while they hang out by the coffee machine. Do you know what I'm saying? Only go in when it's necessary. Leave. Do your work and leave. I've just got to look at the word. Keep your eyes down. Essentially, he's saying keep your eyes down on the Sanhedrin and on the work at hand. other people that are gleaning are going to be roaming to other fields. I don't want you to follow them to a different field. And it will be safer for you to hang about in my field. It's better to wait until other people come to this field and hang out with them than you go to other fields. Boaz also wanted to convey to Ruth that her eyes should be on the field constantly. Even from afar, she should refrain from looking at other people. But only at the field itself. That's what it means, achreihen. The plural, after them, indicates that Boaz wanted her to follow a group of reapers, not a single worker, lest people suspect her of being alone with one person. That was verse 9. I'd like to now do verses 10, 11, 12 together as a block. So can we do verses 10, 11, 12 as a block? Let's look at this. When she heard Boaz say this to her, she fell on her face and spread out on the ground. She fell on her face and spread. Just say she spread out on the ground. And she said to him, "Why is it that I found favor in your eyes that you take notice of me? I am but a stranger." Notice this. Anochi nochriya. Literally, I'm like a foreigner. Boaz answered her, saying, "It has been repeatedly told to me how much you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, of your husband. Could you, if you've got a pencil and you want to make a mark, here's some marks. Write in a number one. One, how you left your father. Two, and your mother. Three, the land of your birth. And four, went to a nation you knew nothing of the day before last." He gives her four separate compliments. But each one is a message. How you left the land of your father is one thing. The land of your mother is another. The land of your birth is another. And coming to a nation you know nothing of is another. May God recompense you for your work. May your reward from the Lord God of Israel, whose wing you have come to seek refuge, be complete. Ooh. Notice, what's the first word of Yud Beis? May God recompense you. Yishalem. You see that word? Shalem being complete. Can you see that? Verse 12. Yishalem. What do those letters spell? Yishalem Hashem. Pa'aleichu sihi. Shalema. May Im Hashem may be complete. Shalema is Shalema. You can reread Shalema as Shalema. He's already alluding, he's got a hunch. She could be the good dove. Shalema might come from her. He's already saying, you have the capacity to be the mother of Shalema. He's alluding to that in his words. It's quite a lot going on here. All right, let's take these three psukim as a block. I said to you, she fell on her face, and then it says she spread out her hands on the ground. Why does it say that? This is a big compliment to Ruth to show you how incredibly modest she was. Had she have spread herself out on the ground immediately, parts of her legs might have been revealed. So she fell on her face first, much as the way the Arabs prostrate themselves today, and then slowly spread out her limbs, ensuring that even her ankles remain covered. Very interesting. Very interesting. Now, Boaz is apologizing for the way that his helper had spoken to about her earlier. To whom does that young woman belong in verse 5? Said the helper in verse 6, she's a Moabite girl. The servant who was the overseeing of the harvesters replied, she's the one that returned with Naomi from the fields of Moab. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. So she came and she's been on her feet since morning until now, except for resting a little in the hut. That's what the guy said. Notice the overseer called her a Moabitess. Boaz contradicted this, which is, by the way, a bit of an insult. It's an insult. Moab is not friendly to the Jews. That's saying she's some German girl. She's the German, she's the young Nazi girl that's come here to glean. That does not have good connotations, even though it may be true. It may be true that she was a young Nazi girl that's come to convert. It's not a nice way to speak about her. So what did Boaz say? I have heard how much you've done for your mother-in-law. Now, it'd be quite normal for you to treat her with disdain. We know that generally, says the Gemara, daughters-in-law are not treated so well by their mothers-in-law and vice versa. It's a tough relationship. Because mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law rarely get on well together. In fact, there's a Gemara in Yevamos 117a that explain that certain biblical laws are actually based upon this phenomena, because everyone is considered trustworthy to bear witness against her except her mother-in-law. If a woman goes to court, you cannot call her mother-in-law as a witness to say, did she do it? Because we usually think a mother-in-law's got it in for the daughter-in-law. That's true. She says the Gemara, she stole the son. She stole the son away from her, and she has enmity against her, and therefore they tend not to get on, generally. They generally tend not to get on. So much of this halachic ruling there. So first of all, it's amazing you're doing such good for your mother-in-law. Generally, mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law don't get on. That's number one. You obviously did not act kindly towards her just to gain favour with your husband, since you did so after your husband's death, which is why the Pasuk points out, after your husband died, you were still nice to her. That's a big compliment. Not only immediately after his death, when people could claim that you did so out of deference for his wishes, but even a long time afterwards, achrei moisi sheikh, a long time. Had you have been a true Nazi, a true Moabitess at heart, you'd never have acted like that. Because Moabites are cruel. That's why we're not allowed to marry into the Moabites, because they were cruel to us. They did not greet the Israelites with bread and water in Deuteronomy 23:5 on the way to the land of Israel. And you're not cruel, so you shouldn't go, you shouldn't be called a Moabitess, even though you are. The overseer in verse 5 and 6 had attempted to downgrade Ruth by saying that she had returned with Naomi. He was insinuating that the reasons for coming to Eretz Yisrael were not pure, but she was merely following Naomi. So Boaz had to countermeasure all of these problems. Now notice, he was saying it loud enough for everyone to hear, we'll learn. He was screaming it out loud to teach everyone a lesson. Do you remember I told you to make 4 points? 1, 2, 3, 4 in the Pasuk. Yeah? Now let's go through them. Many reasons could be given to explain why Ruth followed Naomi besides her wish to live as a Jew. People could have turned around and said, she wanted Naomi to care for her needs and wants. Or she loved Naomi and she just wanted to hang out with her. Or she wanted to leave Moab after all the misfortune she had suffered there, so she followed her mother-in-law when she decided to leave. Or people could think she just hoped that somehow Naomi would repay her financially for the kindness that she had shown her. And when Naomi finds her feet, she'll get a payoff. Those are legitimate things people could say. Is everyone okay with this? Let's see how Boaz counters all these claims. He said like this. Boaz is saying to her in verses 10, 11, and 12, I believe that your intentions are good. You left your father, who was the king. Who is more suitable than a father to care for your needs and wants? You left your mother, point two in the pasuk. Is there any unmarried woman that doesn't love her mother and want to hang out with her mum? It's natural for an unmarried woman or a widow to go back to her family, especially her mother. And the land of your birth, even if you had suffered misfortunes in your hometown, there's plenty of other places to settle in Moab. And you were of a very high rank. You're a princess. But you left your country behind entirely. And you went to a nation you knew nothing about. You didn't merely rely on Naomi for sustenance. You had faith in a people that you knew nothing of. You weren't to know that you'd be able to sustain yourself with gifts for the poor. Nobody had told you the law that you'd get leket and shichah and payah. You were totally reliant on Hashem. Because of your love for him, you were chosen to devote your life to him. Notice we have a rule that if you 100% rely on God, God himself will directly provide for you. If you're 100% online with him, he's 100% online with you. That's why it means you'll come to no harm. Because the Gemara in Pesachim 8b says, those sent to perform a religious duty or commandment don't suffer harm if it's not a dangerous time. So he's saying, as long as you don't put yourself in danger, you're definitely going to be covered because of all the mitzvahs you've done with your mother-in-law. So I know you're going to come to no harm. You've come to seek refuge under his wing, says Boaz. Through your husband, though, even though you lost your husband, and he died because he married you, a Gentile woman, you don't have to worry, because when you came here as a Jewess, you're like a completely brand new baby. Because a convert is considered like a baby. So the overseer accused Rus of constantly looking for ways to steal stalks from the sheaves. That she preferred to be out in the fields rather than in the house. Said he'd only been in the house a little bit, i.e. she was out stealing. Those lies were so obvious that Boaz felt no need to refute them. Everyone could see that she had not taken any gleanings unlawfully. So to make sure that she wasn't cheating by taking three stalks instead of two at a time, it took her longer than anyone else to go through the field because she was so righteous. That's why she was taking time, because you can only pick up two at a time, not three at a time. So Boaz was saying this in the earshot of everyone, so everyone could hear him sticking up for her, because everyone heard the overseer slating her in front of everyone else. Everyone thought, yeah, she's a thief. Very, very important. What does it mean you went to a nation you knew nothing about? What does that mean? Even, what does that mean? Very important. It means even while you were still in Moab, you decided to cut ties because you didn't like their way of life. The people were not your people. Their God was not your God. While you were already still in Moab, only later did you join a nation which you knew nothing of. Hence, you didn't leave them in order to go to another people, but because you detested them in their ways. It wasn't as if you came here because you loved us. You came here because of what you hated in Moab. That's why we can understand the clause, you came to seek refuge. Boaz meant to say you didn't change from being a Moabitess to a Jewess just now. You were already technically a Jewess while you were still in Moab. You just left Moab. While you were in the Vatican, you'd already, slaffed that religion. And now you were looking for something else. You're looking to seek refuge. God will fully pay, Shalema, your quest. That's what he's hinting to at the word Shalema, already starting to hint to her, you have the potential through your actions to be the mother of royalty. Verse 13. We've done 9, 10, 11, 12. Here we go, 13, fifth pasuk. She said, "May I find favor in your eyes, my master, for you have comforted me and spoken gently to your maidservant, though I am not worthy of being one of your maidservants." She didn't call herself a maidservant in the last pasuk. What did she say? She said she was a nochriya. Look at pasuk 10. Look at number 10. Last word. She says, "V'anochi nochriya." I'm a stranger. I'm a stranger. And now, in pasuk 13, she calls herself a shivcha. She says, "I'm your maidservant." That's a bit of a jump, isn't it? I'm like a ger. I'm like a... I'm a goy. I'm not even a ger. I'm like some Moabitess to you. You don't know who I am. The next thing she says, "I'm like, I live in your house. I'm a maidservant of yours." Whew! That's a bit of a jump for her to say that. This is a big deal. Big deal. What does this mean? Notice, "May I find favor in your eyes," for toimer emtachein ba'einecha, is in the future tense. That implies that up until the time she had not found any favor. But if he had comforted her and spoken kindly to her, wasn't that because she had already found favor? Why is she speaking in the future tense, "May I find favor tomorrow"? I think she's found favor today. What she meant to say to Boaz was as follows: "I can't believe that I've attained the level of one who has found favor in your eyes. Unbelievable. I can't believe I've jumped from the level of being a stranger to the way that you're treating me as if I'm literally a member of your household. I am so impressed. Thank you." Also, she's asking, "What have I done to deserve your favor?" If there was a reason for this favor and for the fact that you've given me so much attention, I might have suspected you of believing the overseer's slander. But I don't see any reason for finding favor in your eyes. What have I done to deserve it? So Boaz was saying, in truth, I did not see anything for myself that made me speak to you kindly. But much has been related to me about you and about how kind you've been and about the journey you've been on, and I've been very impressed with the reports. So Rus is saying back, if that's the case, and I do deserve favor, I can understand why you've been so good to me. Your concern is genuine because you've heard about my life and you've given me the impression that I'm your maidservant. I really feel that I'm up there. There are a few categories of women mentioned in this. Firstly, there's the common Gentile, nochriya. Then there's the level of a Jewish maidservant, shivcha. She is a non-Jewish woman who, after going to mikveh, can live together with a Jewish man. But on a higher level is a maidservant who is so worthy that she may serve in the household of the God Lador. And the highest level is a free woman who is worthy enough to associate with the female members of Boaz's household. When Ruth heard that Boaz had given her permission to stay close to the girls, she was surprised to hear that she had jumped all the echelons to being part of his household. That's the highest grade. The highest grade. Verse 14. This is one of the most profound verses in the scroll of Rus. You will not get it by reading it plain. V'yomela, this is one of the most profound verses. Boaz said to her at the mealtime, "Come here and eat bread. Dip your piece in vinegar." She sat behind the reapers. He handed her parched grain. Why did he do that? She ate and was satisfied, so much so that she left some over, which is always a sign of bracha. This verse is so replete and is so profound, there's literally pages and pages of discussion. Essentially, what we learn out for here is the entire Jewish monarchy and how wicked King Menashe did tshuva. And it's all learnt out from the fact that he gave her parched grain. She ate and was satisfied. All of this contains the secrets of tshuva and how the monarchy spiraled out of control into debauchery and avodah zarah. All in this phrase in the pasuk. I won't go into the depth of it now, I can't do it now, but that is an intro for next time. But let's just have a look at some of the words. We're told that Rus sat beside the reapers. Sat beside the reapers. This is after Boaz had told her to come here. Boaz said, come here and eat bread. Then she sat beside the reaper. What's going on? Why didn't the prophet make mention of the fact that Boaz was sitting with the workers? Besides, is it the right thing to do for a good Yiddish girl to go and sit amongst a bunch of male workers? Boaz told her to eat bread and dip it in vinegar. Yet after she took her place at the meal, he offered her parched grain, and no mention is her made of eating the bread and dipping in the vinegar. He said, do this. Go to a restaurant and order spaghetti bolognese. She ate fish and chips. What happened to the spaghetti bolognese? What did you tell us? The Medrash Rabbah 5:6 notes that Boaz gave Rus a little grain with his fingers, but God blessed it so that from that very small amount, she was satisfied so much that she even left over. From this we can see that she didn't eat the bread. She didn't eat the bread, she just ate a few kernels of grain, and God gave a brocha like the mon, that it completely filled up her tummy. That's why she never had to dip the bread in vinegar, because she never ended up eating the bread in vinegar, because she was so blessed by the parched grain. The Medrash says if Boaz had known that God was going to record that he gave her parched grain, he would have given her fattened calves. Remember, Aaron came to meet Moshe very happily, and when Moshe told him, Aaron had no hint of jealousy that Moses is going to be the Messiah, and he was very happy for him. Says the Medrash, had Aaron have known that the Torah itself was going to say that Aaron's going to be happy when he sees you, he'd have brought a band, a whole band, dum-dum-dum-dum, marching cymbals, he'd have had a party. He didn't know the Torah's words are going to be written on this. Again, no mention is made of him giving her bread and vinegar, which is a far higher grade food than a few kernels of barley that it just, here, take this, like a little bit of a, like a leftover, like a token. A guy comes into a room and you give him a handful of peanuts and say, sit down and have a proper meal. You don't expect the peanuts to be all he eats. That's all she ate. As I said, there's a tremendous amount going on here. But unfortunately, we're out of time. We've covered a good amount of ground. We started, I think, on verse 9, and we've got through to verse 14. And the chapter ends at 23. So we're kind of coming up to now halfway mark now through the second chapter. And remember, there's the good news is there's only four chapters in Rus. It looks like, you know, we could really make some good deep ground here. I don't think that I should get into the whole Menashe grain thing now, because we'll start it off and then we'll have to stop. But basically, this is really, really profound. This handful of grain that he gave her, along with a bundle of barley that he gives her later, are extremely profound. These are deep messages for the monarchy of Israel and how things are going to develop and evolve in the society of Knesset Yisrael. Be'ez Hashem, we will do that next time. It's been a wonderful thing to have you here. Thank you so much for taking out your time. If there's any questions on anything we've done up to now, I'm very happy to take any questions. Would anyone would like to ask anything? Wow, okay, that's unusual. I'm glad. Okay, yes. Is there a question coming in? No, are we all good? I hope you have a wonderful week. Thank you so much for joining back after the summer break. And I look forward to discussing this concept of the parched grain. Amazing to do with King Manasseh. And also there's in the next pasuk, there's a really amazing thing to discuss. Then she arose to glean, and Boaz commanded his laborers, saying, it says, V'yotzev Boaz es na'arav lemor. And we're going to learn from that a very interesting thing. Why was Boaz called Boaz? Boaz was a nickname. That wasn't his name. His name was Ivtsan. Why did they call him Boaz? We're going to learn what the word Boaz means, why he was called that, and what the superfluous word was he was saying meant. Please God, we will do that next time. I'm looking forward to doing that with you and seeing how the story develops until Rus and Naomi say, this is it. We've got a strike in chapter 3. The table is going to be set. You're going to have to approach Boaz and just say outright that you're my redeemer. You've got to look after me. How do we build up to that dynamic moment in Jewish history? All the table is being set here in the second chapter that we're learning. I'm looking forward to doing that with you. I hope you have a fantastic week. It's great to see you. Thank you very, very much.